Hello, listeners. I wanted to tell you about something that I use and was part of its inception, Joyful.Gifts. Joyful.Gifts is a service that makes giving gifts very easy and joyful. You tell us who you want to give gifts to, set a budget, and then we select, buy, and ship the gift automatically to every occasion, while you have peace of mind. Best of all, you actually save money, since the software continuously mines the web for the best prices for you. If you want to give it a try, it's at joyful.gifts. No www, no .com. Just type joyful.gifts in your browser, and you're set to go. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Cards, Episode 9, The Liber King. So last time, we looked at the early part of Salah ad-Din's career, his ascension from a vizier to the Sultan of Egypt to the Sultan of Egypt in Syria was an asterisk, given that Aleppo stayed out of reach. Now, one thing you might wonder, where were the Crusaders in all of this? Sure, they showed up briefly when Nur ad-Din died to collect tribute from Damascus, but for the whole time Salah ad-Din was fighting Aleppo and its allies in Syria, a very good time to make strategic acquisition, mind you, they were completely absent. Well, during that campaign in Damascus, the King of Jerusalem, same guy that rushed the conquest of Egypt a couple of episodes ago, got sick and died at the young age of 38. Now, when he died, there was a lot of family drama that was going on behind the scenes in Jerusalem. It's a little bit out of our scope, but the gist of it is, the now deceased king had two children, a 13-year-old Baldwin and an older sister, both, however, from an annulled marriage. The king, when he died, was married to a Byzantine princess, who also had her own offspring, only an infant girl at this point. Making matters worse, Baldwin, the presumed heir, was not only a teenager, but it was an open secret that he had leprosy, rendering one of his arms dead. So, not an ideal heir by any measure. Still, he managed to get crowned. Perhaps as many factions hoped to be able to influence the court through him. So, as Salah ad-Din was marching through Syria, Baldwin got sicker and sicker from leprosy, and his court avoided conflict as much as possible, signing a truce with the Kurdish Sultan. More importantly so, internally, the king leprosy was a huge problem. Remember, this is medieval Palestine, not that much difference from Roman/Jewish Palestine, where leprosy was a curse from God, a sign of divine disfavor, was a lot of social and religious stigma. So, regardless of what Baldwin did or didn't do, plenty of folks just did not buy into his leadership, waiting for him to die. He, really, through no fault of his own, was like a zombie king, alive just enough to prevent someone else taking his place. Yet, quite did, if not by action, as he really did try, then definitely in the hearts and minds of his subjects. On top of that, he was infertile. As such, he could produce no heir. And even if he wanted to abdicate the throne for someone else, no one really had the dynastic legitimacy required for a smooth transition. In theory, his older sister could marry someone powerful from Europe and go from there. But when she did, her husband died in less than a year, leaving her a pregnant widow, where her infant son was now the presumed heir, complicating any future marriages. So yeah, as Salah ad-Din finished his campaigns in Syria and was being recognized as the leader of the Muslim world, the Franks were divided and without a leader. Now, despite his later reputation as a champion of jihad and the propaganda of his time, Salah ad-Din was more of a practical politician than an ideologically driven warrior of faith. He tried to avoid meaningless wars with the Franks or anyone else for that matters, focusing instead on consolidating his internal rule, fostering trade, and, if the opportunity arises, adding small pieces to his empire via smart diplomacy or short campaigns. So, as he went back to Egypt in late 1176, he had no grand plans against the Franks, opting instead to literally take a vacation in Alexandria with his young 6-year-old son, quite literally hanging out at the beach, with his older brother managing things in Syria, and his younger brother still part of the day-to-day operation in Egypt. After the vacation, he attended to the practical consideration of governing, fortifying cities, building a navy, judging civil cases, and strengthening a communication network between Syria and Egypt. He also embarked on a massive building project, where he literally ordered a lot of the smaller ancient pyramids destroyed, using the stones to build a massive wall around Cairo and Fustat, as well as an impressive citadel overlooking the city in the Mu'attam Mountains, still standing to this day. His son would eventually try the same, but with the smaller pyramids gone, he would go for the big famous 3 pyramids that are still standing to this day. As you can imagine, so it ended in complete failure, as it took hundreds of men, and they only managed to remove one stone per day, in an effort lasting for 8 months. So it was just a massive waste of money and effort. So yeah, the myth of Salah ad-Din, or his son, attempting to demolish the pyramids, is partially true. Anyway, I digress. The point is, despite seeing the Franks as a zombie king, Salah ad-Din had better things to do than go on a massive campaign of jihad. First, it was meaningless in the grand scheme of things and the welfare of his citizens. And second, the fortunes of war are unpredictable. A campaign like that might bring in Byzantium or the monarchs of Europe and turn the whole region into a mess. What for? Over in Jerusalem, however, things proceeded differently. The Liber King by now had reached legal adulthood, 16. And as he did, he dismissed his previous advisors, a diplomatic court that avoided conflict thus far, replacing them with one that refused to renew the truce with Salah ad-Din. Why? Well, it could be just classic crusader style, God wilted, macho man foolishness. But to give them credit, there seemed to have been a deal with Alibo, where several high-ranking knights were released from captivity, Baldwin's uncle among them, and a certain Renald of Chatillon, a knight with a reputation of excessive violence, dragging at some point and beating up the Patriarch of Antioch to squeeze money out of the patriarchy. So, their release may have been the seed of a potential alliance against Salah ad-Din, especially as these guys went straight from captivity to court, ending up very high up the chain and extremely close to Baldwin. As soon as they got out, they immediately organized a raid against Salah ad-Din, older brother in Syria, and defeated him in a minor engagement somewhere in modern Lebanon. A symbolic, if not significant, victory. By 1177, as the new citadel was being built in Cairo, Renald was putting the final touches on another combined Byzantine crusader invasion. Renald was putting the final touches on another combined Byzantine crusader invasion of Egypt. A serious threat if executed correctly. As always with these things, so, as the Byzantine fleet arrived in Acre and a powerful European warlord joined, pity argument broke out of who was really in charge, and more importantly, how to divide the conquered territory. The Greek Navy commander then called it a day and ordered that the fleet go back to Constantinople. Nonetheless, to not waste the effort, a crusader raid took place anyway, where they besieged and failed to capture a couple of Syrian cities. Watching with extreme annoyance at all of this was Salah ad-Din. While he probably considered the Franks to be a minor nuisance, he took the threat of a Byzantine navy and European arrivals very seriously, and mobilized his army when he heard that there was a Byzantine navy in Acre. When the threat dissipated, he decided to go and campaign anyway. Not to capture Jerusalem or anything like that. No, just more of a punitive campaign, and to cover his expenses via tribute if possible. So, marching at the head of a very well-trained Mamluk army of 20,000 horsemen or so, he headed toward Palestine in November 1177. The European arrivals, plus most of the manpower of the crusaders, were still besieging those two cities in Syria. So meeting that Mamluk army was a measly force of 600 knights, plus a couple of thousand infantry, led by, as one of our sources put it, quote, "a sick king, already half dead." After a brief engagement near the walls of Ashkelon, where the Franks were naturally easily overwhelmed, the Liber King and his troops retreated to Ashkelon and closed the door. Now, if this was your typical holy war campaign, Salah ad-Din would have besieged Ashkelon, attempted to capture the king, and moved to the holy city of Jerusalem. Or, if confident, leaving his rear exposed, ignore Ashkelon altogether and go to Jerusalem right away. But it wasn't. It was a punitive campaign to cover the expenses of war. So, he told his men to fan out, to raid and loot as many villages and towns as possible, to capture as many slaves and sellable goods. You know, to earn their pay. Now, morality of medieval war aside, where farmers and civilians are being targeted here, this was a rational and a calculated move. The thing that Salah ad-Din did not count on, so, was the classic crusader-style, God-willed, macho-man foolishness. Rather than stay in Ashkelon with his 600 knights, Baldwin decided to force a battle. As his secretary and one of the primary sources for this period puts it, quote, "he felt that it was wiser to try the dubious chances of battle with the enemy than to suffer his people to be exposed to rape, fire, and massacre." So, like a messianic figure rising from the dead, 3 days later, with the army of Salah ad-Din fanned out, and only a small unit guarding him, still numbering in the low thousands, but, you know, not the whole army, Reynald of Chatillon picked a hill overlooking a small river that Salah ad-Din and his bodyguards were expected to cross. And as the Sultan's army was crossing the river, the 600 knights, plus about 80 knights or so, Knight Templars, unleashed the heavy charge, where the Sultan had the river at his back, and the dust of the Franks' charge at his front. Immediately recognizing what was about to happen, he ran as fast as he could. To their credit, his Mamluks, also recognizing that the battle was lost, did not run, rather forming what little defense that they could, to give the Sultan a chance to cross the river back and run. It was a complete rout, with the crusaders taking no prisoners and hunting down every Mamluk that they could find, until night fell. To make matters worse for the Sultan, the Bedouin of Sinai, usually opportunistic guns for hire, heard of the defeat and decided to sack the camp of Salah ad-Din, where money, food, and weapons were being kept. And so, by December, Salah ad-Din gathered what men he could find, and limped back to Egypt. Without much food or water, in freezing rain, where the cold nights of the desert could kill a man of exposure. A humiliating defeat that tarnished the carefully crafted image of Salah ad-Din, the Sultan, the victorious, the political leader of the Muslim world. The defeat was not only humiliating psychologically, it opened up a couple of internal issues that were boiling under the surface. Basically, as always, Syria was a tough place to govern, and Salah ad-Din's older brother was an incompetent administrator. And a tricky thing about the family business that Salah ad-Din was building is that you can't just fire your brother for incompetence. So, long story short, rather than dismissing his brother, he tried to reassign him to another rich area, but that was not as important strategically as Damascus. Problem was that Arya already had a popular ruler who had been nothing but loyal to Salah ad-Din. If he fired him, at worst, a rebellion would break out. At best, other loyal governors will take note. So ideally, the goal was to get the governor to resign. And after a mix of diplomacy, sending an army to the area, then diplomacy again, it did happen and the governor resigned. But it was a major distraction that allowed the crusaders to build on the momentum of victory. To appreciate the significance of what is about to happen, I think a bit about how frontiers worked in the 12th century is necessary. There was no modern nation-state like border between Damascus and Jerusalem. No, it was more of zones of influence. No man land kind of areas where it was always dangerous to go there, regardless if you came from Damascus or Jerusalem. If let's say the Franks built a castle there, then all of a sudden it was a lot safer for them and more dangerous if you're coming from Damascus. Eventually, with a little bit of time, it will no longer be a no man's land. No, just a territory that belongs to Jerusalem, while the no man's zone will move deeper into Damascene territory. And so, as Salah ad-Din was embroiled in his brother's saga, the court in Jerusalem decided to start building a castle only a day's journey away from Damascus, at a strategic crossing point in the Jordan River, a move that was bound to change the dynamic of trade and power in the area. It would literally mean no caravan from Egypt can ever make it safely to Damascus, not to mention everyday communication between Cairo and Damascus needed to govern would be very difficult. Building that castle was important enough that Baldwin left Jerusalem altogether and made the building site his seat of government. As for Salah ad-Din, well, it would have been an unmitigated disaster if the castle was completed. So, unwilling to fight the crusaders again after the last time, and distracted by the internal politics of Syria, he actually offered to pay them tribute. 60,000 dinars first, and when that refused, 100,000 dinars was offered. But Baldwin refused to entertain the offer. And so, Salah ad-Din, the practical politician, was left no choice but to pursue holy war. He wrapped the issue with his brother and moved to Damascus, where first he attempted a show of force to again possibly persuade the crusaders to negotiate. But the show of force only created enough of a delay to allow the crusaders to complete the walls and the structure of the castle. It was not quite a castle just yet, but with walls and tower, it was a defensible enough position to allow for the king to leave the area and call the project a success. Again, extremely reluctant to go all in, Salah ad-Din started sending raids to test the waters. The castle, but not yet castle so,
was manned by Knight Templars, and as they were the elite warriors of the region, every raid ended up with one of Salah ad-Din's generals, sometimes friends, captured or dead. One of the raids was successful, though, in that it managed to capture several high-ranking Templar knights, which threw their hierarchy off for a bit. Finally, seeing no other option but fully committing to the cause, Salah ad-Din gathered his full army and set his sights on that castle. Again, so, the object here was not an all-out war. No, it was simply to take and destroy that castle, to keep trade and communication flowing between Damascus and Cairo. And, hoping to avoid any open battles, Salah ad-Din's plan was to quickly reach the castle, set every siege engine he got, plus miners, specialized soldiers who mine tunnels under the walls, on it, and then hopefully take the castle, destroy it, and go back before Baldwin or any army gets there. And that's how it played out. Also, it was extremely close and bloody. Apparently, the idea behind mining was to dig a tunnel, back it with wood, and then burn that wood down so the walls above the tunnel collapses. Well, it turned out that the tunnel that Salah ad-Din miners dug was too small. The tunnel was about to go away without collapsing the walls. And as digging another tunnel would have taken too long, in desperation, the Sultan offered a gold dinar for each soldier carrying a goat skin of water from the river to extinguish the flames. And when the fire was put down successfully, work continued day and night to enlarge the mine. And even when it was big enough, only a small part of the walls collapsed, just enough for a few men to go in at a time, which meant it was a 300-style-like battle, where a few hundred Templar knights battled wave after wave of Mamluk's assault, while fire is raging all around them. And Baldwin, the Liber King, leading a relief army that was only 6 hours away. Like the movie, the garrison of the castle was eventually overrun, and all of them died in the sack. Muslim eyewitnesses say that there were about 1,000 coats of armor and a mountain of weapons that were collected from the dead in the stores of the castle. Baldwin made it close enough to the castle that he saw the smoke from the fire rising, at which point he decided that the battle was lost and he went back. Salah ad-Din, not knowing this and still trying to avoid a battle with a full crusader army, raced to destroy the castle, ordering that his men literally push all the corpses in one corner, since there was no time to bury them, while in the same time leading personally an attempt to take down the place stone by stone. The castle was well built, and within 2 weeks, with the corpses in the open, a plague broke out, ravaging the Muslim army and killing 10 of Salah ad-Din's generals. And was the job almost done, but not quite there yet? The Sultan, afraid of catching the plague himself, ordered that the army leave the seemingly cursed castle as a ruin of horror, where it stood as a monument to both sides on what war would bring. A truce was then signed, where neither side paid tribute and both sides agreed to build no castles. It seemed like everyone had had enough. Salah ad-Din went back to empire building, while the Liber King went back to dying slowly. The Sultan followed up his truce with the Crusaders with a peace treaty with Byzantium, who had suffered another big loss to the Sultanate of Rum, i.e. the Seljuks of Anatolia, and were reconsidering their whole alliancing with the Crusaders that seemed to bring nothing but trouble.
And just to close the loop there, I'm actually going to skip for a few years, where a period of civil unrest would see a massacre of all the Latins living in Constantinople, ending the facade of cooperation between the two powers and initiating a period of hostility between Byzantium and the Franks. Similarly, a non-aggression pact was secured with the Armenians, who, by this point, had their own little state, stuck between Syria and Anatolia. Lastly, completing the diplomatic encirclement of Aleppo, the Abbasid Caliph died, and Salah ad-Din went out of his way to earn the support of the new Caliph. And once this was completed, in again what seemed like the perfect timing, Nur al-Din's son, the other Sultan of Syria, living in Aleppo, died, only 19 years old. An event that shortly led to the armies of Salah ad-Din marching again toward Aleppo. Interestingly so, they marched through Crusader territory, where both sides took great pain to avoid open conflict. To the dismay of Salah ad-Din, so, Aleppo did not open their door, and he, a master of propaganda, rather than engage in a highly damaging civil war with Aleppo, decided to pivot and attack the Crusaders. Again, picking his targets carefully and avoiding all or nothing battles. The goal here wasn't to defeat the Crusaders, no, just create an image of a pious warrior of the faith that wants to unite the Muslims, i.e., Aleppo, please let me in, I'm doing the work of God. A half-hearted siege of Beirut then took place, where his army mostly looted the countryside, until the Crusader showed up and he decided to leave. During that campaign, Salah ad-Din fired one letter after another to the Caliph, asking him to essentially declare fellow Muslims valid targets of jihad if they refused to help in his fight against the Franks, basically suggesting that he should be empowered to subjugate any Muslims who refused to join him in jihad, while in the same light describing the rulers of Aleppo and Mosul as rebellious enemies of the state. They, in an interesting evolution of political thought, were accused of seizing power on the grounds of hereditary succession, when, lawfully, command of these cities should have been the gift of the Caliph. It was really a work of art, and it bore partial fruit, as at least one warlord around Mosul promised Salah ad-Din assistance if he were to cover the Euphrates and come there. By this point, playing on a whole different level strategically than everyone else, Salah ad-Din went, capturing enough of a territory to isolate and threaten Mosul, then going back to Aleppo and offering that territory to its ruler in return for the Syrian city. A deal that was concluded in 1183, removing the asterisk from his Sultanate of Syria. Now, Aleppo, like Cairo when he took over, was a hodgepodge of ethnicities and religions. And when he arrived, it was through a backdoor deal with its ruler. So, the average citizen of Aleppo was not exactly a fan. But, copying the playbook from his time as vizier, he enforced demitude strictly and cancelled taxes and debts. Within 6 months, he created a base of support within the city populace, mainly from its Sunni elements, enough that it greatly diminished the threat of civil unrest. That same base of support, though, clamored for Salah ad-Din to fulfill his promises, to liberate Jerusalem and take back the Aqsa Mosque. And he, for his part, well, he wasn't really excited about it. But if, let's say, classic Crusader style got wolded, macho man foolishness leads one of the knights to attack Mecca itself, well, What choice does the Sultan have then? Thank you for listening. Farewell, and until next time.